And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for late July, early August 2022. Today in particular, the carbon dioxide level, the global carbon dioxide level is 419.35 parts per million, and there were 2,731 days left before the year 2030. The clock keeps ticking. Today, we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm happy to be here.
Glad to have you along. So, Boston is blessed to be the home of what are called garden cemeteries, which are conceptions of how people ought to or can, you know, exercise their last will and, you know, be in a place they want to be. And there's all kinds of cultural things around cemeteries. In particular, Mount Auburn Cemetery is one of the most famous. It's in Cambridge. It's right on Mount Auburn Avenue. It's a beautiful spot. We'll get into the details in a little bit. But I keep saying that climate change touches every aspect of life. And now I realize it also touches some aspects of death. I mean, how do you, as we proceed down the path of trying to rebuild the world, rethinking how, you know, basically burial practices can be brought in line with the things that we need to do to have a sustainable world. So a few weeks ago in Commonwealth Magazine, which is a great place to catch up on lots of interesting things. If you ever, Commonwealth Magazine is online. There was an op-ed piece in particular about Mount Auburn Cemetery and the connection to climate. And it was such an interesting topic that we were able and were fortunate to have with us the president and CEO of Mount Auburn Cemetery, Mr. Matthew Stevens. How are you doing, Matthew? Welcome aboard.
Very good. Thank you for having me on such a beautiful day.
It is beautiful. And Matthew, please tell me the story about what Mount Auburn Cemetery is, what it represents, sort of the cultural intersection that it sits at, right? Both historically and modern day. I mean, there's a whole collection of things around the topic that we could pursue. So, you know, did I tell the story right? And what direction do you think, what do you think people ought to know?
Great first question. You know, Mount Auburn Cemetery is really the original of the garden cemeteries in the United States. Founded in 1831, our founders had a revolutionary idea at that time to, you know, there was, death wasn't well known and Boston was becoming more and more urbanized. And so there was this sort of concept to move an active cemetery out into the rural area of Boston. And so Mount Auburn was the, you know, the start of the rural cemetery movement in the United States that incorporated the land and landscape into death and death care. And so what had, you know, most cemeteries prior to Mount Auburn had been defined by what most people think of cemeteries, long rows of monuments, all in a straight line, lined up behind a church with nothing but monuments and grass. And so Mount Auburn really broke the mold where our founders, you know, had this really incredible idea. And you have to think, it was 1830s, as there's, you know, or late 1820s when they were thinking of this idea. This was before what we have today, you know, modern day parks, right? And so green spaces, green oases amongst urban centers didn't exist, right? And so to think that we would set aside land where the landscape would really be the feature of what people would come to visit was really revolutionary, right? And so, you know, that our founders had that idea, started it, and, you know, very interesting, after Mount Auburn was founded, for many years after it opened, it was the single greatest attraction in the United States, because people would come to see this green space that existed that didn't really exist anywhere else, right? And, you know, that's a piece that I don't think many people fully understand. And, you know, one of the reasons Mount Auburn is a national landmark is because of this very unique place and time and this revolutionary idea that our founders had of sort of having the foresight to see how death and life can coexist in these special places. And, you know, now throughout the country, there are a series of garden cemeteries. I would say probably Mount Auburn, Greenwood are probably the two most well-known. And, you know, but there's really a series of them. And as you know, one of the things many cemeteries have is time, right? Where as the world has reimagined itself many times over from 1831, you know, these cemeteries have remained approximately the same. And so there's, because of that, there are these incredible monuments, but also a landscape that is unmatched, right? If you come to Mount Auburn, I guarantee you will see the best collection of mature trees anywhere north of the Mason-Dixon line.
There's so much to unpack what you said. It's fascinating. I mean, let me just start out that if you were to go to Mount Auburn today, it is probably 100 yards from the Charles River. It is completely surrounded by Cambridge. So the idea that this area would have been considered rural, right, in the 18th, you know, that already tells you how much the world has developed around it. And you're saying this patch of ground has been captured and held, I mean, you know, dedicated use. So you have all these, this wonderful continuity. But then the other interesting thing you said was that it was a destination. It was a right. place that people would go because of the beauty, even in times, you know, before Cambridge, Watertown, everything was built up around it, right? That it was sufficiently, that's really cool.
Right. And, you know, what's sort of ironic, which you just already noted, is, you know, we're not rural at all. We're, you know, deeply urbanized, and Mount Auburn is now a sort of green oasis or sponge, you know, that is absorbing, you know, tons of carbon dioxide and stormwater. And, you know, it's really become this intricate part of the ecology of, you know, our communities. And, you know, we see, you know, what's interesting, again, many people don't see Mount Auburn as a place for life, but we have this like deep and thriving ecology of birds, reptiles, you know, of course, humans who are up on, you know, 2 feet enjoying the landscape. And, you know, that really produces this sort of unique mix where, you know, there's a reason all of this wildlife is sort of floating around our site. Because when you look from above, you know, Mount Auburn is this patch, dense, dark patch of green amongst a sea of concrete.
So tell me, what the... I mean, this is a short podcast, not a graduate seminar, but sure. Can you talk a little bit about the conceptions of death that might have gone from the 1830s through, because I mean, I live out rural, outside, not rural, but I mean, outside on the 495 loop around sure. Boston, and the graves out here are all, you know, sort of date back to the 1790s, and they all have this sort of skull with the angel wings on it, right? Whatever that meant, right? If you talk about the different gravestones within, what do you see in the evolution of how people think of it? And of course, we're headed to a modern conception, right? We want to talk about how all this connects to climate change. Sure. But I mean, what is there a through line there in sort of the monuments as reflective of the way people think about the afterlife or what they want to be?
Very much so. As you know, I'm new to the cemetery world. You know, I ran a public garden really in my past life. But you know, what I'm learning is that people's final decision or action, they want it to be reflective of who they were or how they viewed the world. That hasn't changed as far as I can tell over 100 years or 1,000 years or longer, right? And so, you know, we have, you know, that being said, there are also trends or, you know, design iconography, right, that is standard through time or evolves, right? And so when you come to Mount Auburn, I sort of make the case that we're an active cemetery, a botanical garden, and a museum. And I have some people who scratch their heads. They're like, well, what do you mean a museum? And, you know, we have 60,000 monuments throughout the grounds. Of those monuments, some are mundane and sort of what you see, what you would imagine in a Hollywood movie is for a headstone. You know, some are unique, distinct pieces of art that there's one of a kind and it's only here, right? And that those range from traditional obelisks to, you know, some of our newer ones are like ultra modern art, right? You know, that you wouldn't actually be able to tell whether they were part of the landscape or a monument. And, and you know, we have like, you know, all different mediums, stainless steel, granite, you know, marble, right? All, yeah, all of the under the sun, right? And so when you come here, you know, that sort of experience with the monuments, you know, is a sort of deep, we hope, is a deeply enriching visit at a cultural institution, not just an active cemetery.
And you said you had 60,000
60,000 monuments. So we call them, so the people who are here forever, we call them permanent residents. So we have 60,000 monuments and over 100,000 permanent residents, and we're adding more each day. You know, we are an active cemetery, and we intend to be an active cemetery, as far as I can tell, for another couple hundred years. You know, at least, you know, and death trends are evolving. What we know is that traditional burials where you get buried in a casket are, you know, at least in the Massachusetts region, you know, are starting to phase out and be replaced by a larger tendency towards cremation, right? And if you don't know, you know, just the amount of square, like land that you use for a full casket burial versus a, you know, cremation is a fraction, right? And so, you know, as we see more and more people leaning towards cremation, you know, we see that as a lower footprint just in, you know, square footage.
Well, that brings us to the whole connection of Mount Auburn Cemetery and burial practices to climate issues, right? And so lay out the connection. Why would you say those two things in the same sentence, right? Why would you even think about it?
I think that's a great question. You know, a few years ago, you know, because really the unique piece of Mount Auburn is it's the landscape that has received national landmark designation. It's the landscape, the buildings, the monuments, they're all supporting features of that designation. So the landscape is what's most important about us. And so knowing that the landscape is, you know, king, queen, that means we should be thinking about our landscape here and beyond our gates with, you know, and prioritizing that in meaningful decisions that we make. And so Mount Auburn's position on sustainability and tracking our carbon footprints stems from a desire to preserve our earth or to be a leader in what we do for other cemeteries, other public gardens, other museums, so that we can show them, yes, you can do this, and here's how. So, you know, we developed a climate action plan, you know, just finalized over the last year, which aims to make Mount Auburn carbon neutral by 2050. You know, we've already reduced our carbon footprint by 20% over the last few years.
Well, I'd love to hear more about the, you know, how you've reduced your footprint. But one of the things that I do want to make sure to talk about is, what do you think some of the obstacles to other places doing this? Like, I was thinking about the fact that you say you have a background, you know, in your past life, you did more with the gardening side. Is that an obstacle to people who maybe, you know, a president of a cemetery somewhere else that is thinking about this garden cemetery, but is sort of like, I've got no experience in the garden piece of this?
I think the biggest obstacle is that it's very complicated, right? Yeah. You know, why don't more people leave sustainable lives? Why don't people eat less red meat, take less flights, bike more? Is because it gets complicated with the way that urban living has been constructed. And so when you run an organization, these place-based organization, you have, and especially these historic, some historic means old, right? And so, yeah, that means there is a complex infrastructure and the sequence of buildings and facilities and business processes that are historic along with that, right? And so that means, you know, you have this organization that's running that, you know, it's hard to become modernized. And even Mount Auburn, you know, we see that. And it also means that it raises some really tricky questions. So for example, you know, we have seen a surge in cremation, right? So cremation is fueled by natural gas, right? That's a very basic explanation of how the process works. There will be a decision for Mount Auburn at some point. Do we want to cease providing natural gas fueled cremations, even though our clients desire that, right? You know, that's something that they may desire, but we're going to make a value statement. Well, that's not good for the planet. So we're going to say we don't do that here, or direct you to other disposition methods. And you know, there's tension there, because our hope and our effort, and we spend like a crazy amount of time and energy trying to figure out how can we serve the guests that can come here on a daily basis? How can we serve the families that come here? You know, we are highly relevant to hundreds of families a year in which we're providing, you know, end of life care to. And so that is like a very pragmatic of, well, what are we going to do? You know, how are we going to answer that question? You know, and we know how much natural gas we use and how much our sort of natural gas guzzling crematory uses. And it is one of the larger pieces of our carbon footprint for the site.
Fascinating. Tell me, just not to get too, to geek out too much, but I mean, natural gas, so cremation using natural gas, I mean, I'm just thinking, what if you use hydrogen, get a hot flame? Would that be something that, so, I mean, would that be within the confines? It would certainly have lower CO, not perfect, but it would have lower CO2 emissions, right?
That's correct. And so, you know, I think that will be, we're not ready to answer that question today, you know, but, and, you know, I think one of the other questions that raises is like, well, maybe there's even other disposition methods that would be, you know, greener or more friendly to, you know, to that final decision. And, you know, one of the tricky parts is that because this hasn't got a lot of attention, there's not a lot of really well-known documentation of what is the carbon footprint for a traditional casket burial? What is the carbon footprint for cremation? What is the carbon footprint for a green burial? What is the carbon footprint for, you know, organic reduction? You know, right? And so, you know, one of the things that, you know, Mount Auburn hopefully will be working with partners over the coming years is really to sort of track that, so that we could say, in an academic way, here is what our carbon footprint is. That being said, we know there's other disposition methods that don't rely on natural gas, right?
And can you describe the other disposition methods? I think you just made reference to
organic.
Sure. Yeah. So there's, you know, there's two other methods that are growing in demand. You know, one is called really aquamation, and so it's really cremation. A flameless cremation, and is done with water and an alkaline, you know, solution where the body is essentially dissolved. Uh-huh. And then there is an organic reduction where a human body is essentially turned into compost through a very curated, you know, process in a very controlled facility.
Uh-huh. The alkaline hydrolysis does still leave the bones behind, right? So you have to do a little bit of cremation, or do you just grind them?
So there's some processing that's required, and you know, one of the, I don't know if it's a secret, but sort of not well known facts, that even in cremation, you know, there's some processing that occurs to the bones afterwards. And, you know, so with alkaline hydrolysis, there would also be some processing, you know, right. To, you know, most people think of like, well, I get a bag of dust, and so, you know, that's the final product. And, you know, there is some processing that goes on.
Right.
So it's really, really interesting. I'm thinking a couple of cases. One is that the Mount Auburn Cemetery is now thoroughly there's trees everywhere, right? It's harder to dig 6 foot deep, you know, casket size holes because you're going to interfere with the roots. So there must be a premium on smaller volumes. And you say, you know, it takes a small volume to inter some right. of the remains of some of these things. So that's an important thing. And the other side of the coin is to Mariah's question, just as an observation of it. Over Memorial Day, we visited the various graves of my family, and you can see that half of the older half of the cemetery that we visited had lots of trees and stuff. And then you get out and there's just this big field, right, where people are in rows, right? My parents are in right. rows, no trees anywhere, right? Right. And I guess the question of, from Mount Auburn's perspective, it seems like it would not be great to have a concrete bunker that you put the casket into and then put in the hole in the ground. It just takes up a lot of space, right?
Yeah. And, you know, to dive deeper, because this is a very nuanced business I'm uh-huh. learning, is that, you know, for a traditional casket burial, you really get interred inside of a concrete liner or box that sort of helps support that. You know, that because over time as the casket or body, you know, decompose, you know, if without that that vault or liner, you a machine or human, you know, there's going to be subsidence. Mm-hmm. And I think the current statistic that sort of blew my mind away, if you took all of the casket burials in the United States for a single year, you could build the Golden Gate. You could build the Golden Gate Bridge twice. So that's the amount wow. of steel and concrete that is going into the ground for full body burials every that's year amazing. In the United States, right? And so, when you think about the carbon footprint tied to building two Golden Gate bridges every single year,
yeah.
it's noteworthy.
Yeah. And yeah, that's an amazing statistic. I just point out to the listener who may not be that far, you know, the manufacturer of the cement that makes these vaults is a very carbon intensive, right? Makes a lot of carbon dioxide to make that cement. So the idea that you're going to make all this carbon dioxide and then basically bury it to the tune of two Golden Gate bridges a year,
right.
that's a stunning kind of statistic. And it really, wow.
Mm.
Wow. So, I guess in the op-ed that you wrote, you were making a case that the state of Massachusetts should be rethinking. And of course, Mount Auburn is kind of a leading edge place, right? That yeah. that can has the, I don't know what the right word is, but the capacity to ask these kind of questions, right?
That's right.
Why cannot these alkaline reduction or these other methods, are they illegal? Are they just oversight? I mean, why is there a problem in taking advantage of that?
Yeah, so there's alkaline hydrolysis and this organic reduction that are simply not allowed, you know, by you know, the laws in the state. And so alkaline hydrolysis is allowed in, I think, 15 or so other states. And then this organic reduction, I think, is just allowed in Washington or Oregon. And mm-hmm. so, you know, they're newer ways of disposition methods. Many people have never heard of them, which is, you know, normal. And I had never heard of them before, you know, taking this role, you know, but they're out there and they're starting to gain, you know, popularity. And so, you know, one of the questions that I get asked is like, well, if I, you know, what could I do to help, you know, what, and, you know, we're interested in the business of providing our clients, you know, what they want and providing them sort of care and comfort in their final decision. And so if this is something that, you know, they're interested in, you know, we're happy to talk to them, but, you know, obviously, you know, there are other people who control, you know, what is allowed in the state and there are not.
In terms of being allowed, is it just because the state bureaucracy, the state government moves slowly and that this is something new that they haven't reacted to? Or is there a moral objection to it? Or do they say, oh, it's sanitary? Or, I mean, is there any argument against it?
I'm not sure. That's a good question. I'm not sure that there is an argument against it. And just recently, two very smart, adept legislators, had a conversation, wanted to have a conversation with Mount Auburn about this. And, I think they're very forward thinking and sort of wanting to like make sure that the state is positioned in a place where the residents, have the choices that, that they want. And so I think there are gears in the work, and it's not from oversight. It's just from, well, these are sort of new, and now that they're sort of floating around and become more mainstream. Although they're by no means mainstream, because many people haven't heard of them, but they're becoming more regular, and people have heard about them. And every once in a while, you'll see an article that'll get published of someone in South Africa or in Oregon, whatever, someone famous has, passed away and they've chosen one of these new techniques.
So, I mean, the question of, I guess I would make the case that people, not to be morbid, but I mean, this is a fact of life. I mean, you want to think about this stuff of what do you want, right? And it's like long-term planning, right? Everyone says it's only going to happen, right? My plan is to die in a hang gliding accident at the age of 105, right? I mean, that's so fine. But I mean, how should people approach these kinds of questions?
Well, I mean, the first starts with talking about it. And so, Ted, what are your end of life care decisions after they take you out of that hang glider, right? What's going to happen? And, many people don't want to think about it. I think in Western culture, death is not talked about in as open way as it is in other places. And so we really encourage our guests and our families to talk to one another, right? To talk to their next of kin or whoever will be responsible for managing their affairs, to make what their final decision will be, what it will be. What we have seen as a result of COVID is that has been a wake-up call for many people. I don't think there is anyone at this point who hasn't lost someone close to them, right? And if you have been in the position where you've had to manage end-of-life decisions after someone has already passed, you understand that is a very difficult place to be amongst already being in a very difficult place. And so we really encourage people to plan ahead. Is there a right age? I don't know that there's a right age. Certainly it can never be too early, and there's no wrong age. And certainly I think even an informal conversation or two with loved ones would go a long ways. And certainly if you'd look to a place like Mount Auburn or another cemetery to sort of really tidy up your affairs and make sure that they're in order, that your disposition method, mm-hmm. if you're looking for internment space, that is all resolved before you're depart or before you get to a place where you don't even want to think about it. And I think we hear that too, is like, well, I'm just trying to get this taken care of so that I actually don't have to think about it the next few years. I could just enjoy the remaining years that I have.
Wow. Fascinating. I mean, I get a kick out of talking about climate stuff because you end up in the most logical, but at the same time, most interesting kinds of discussions, right? I mean, this is not something I would have pinned as a interesting topic, but it certainly is. I mean, the idea of how your final deposition, I think, is how green is that is one an interesting question to wrestle with.
Right? Yeah, and ultimately, I think what we're observing is that many people are taking that sort of I don't want to leave a trace, right? I'd actually like my sort of final action to try to be as least disturbance to this incredible planet, right? And we're hopeful that that single decision with other decisions will continue to contribute to, you know, a place in the world that our future generations won't look at us and sort of shake their heads, sort of like we're doing here at the active moments, that, you know, we all know these small things do matter, right? And when you add, you know, disposition method with travel, with food choices, and you magnify that towards thousands or millions of people, there is a significant impact that you can have on this incredible planet.
Wow. Wow. So Tom, if someone wanted to go online, learn more, what's the website? Can they take a tour of Mount Auburn if they're in out on the West Coast or something? Is there
can take a tour of Mount Auburn from the West Coast or from China or from Germany, right? That is on our website, mountauburn.org.
Simple as that. One word, mountauburn.org.
You could follow us also on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. And then one great way to keep and connect with us is, you know, we do have a regular newsletter that goes out with, you know, all the happenings of what's going on at Mount Auburn, because again, we are really working to make Mount Auburn a place for life just as much as a place for death.
And you must offer tours or something, like Sunday morning tour of the
place? Tours on a regular basis. That's great. Have the most incredible cadre of docents that know about our most famous permanent residents, their history, their stories. You know, aside from being a landscape, we are this incredible storyscape, right? Because we have so many incredible people and we're eager to share their stories on a daily basis. We're open 365 days a year, 7 days a week, sunrise to sunset.
That's fantastic. That is remarkably cool. I mean, I what we'll do is we'll put up links to some of the things. That'll be at the MCAN blog. If I can ever get my password corrected, I will be posting that. And you can read that blog at the MCAN website. It's at massclimateaction.org. You go there, massclimateaction.org. Across the banner, you'll see something, newsletter and more. Click on that, pull it down. There's blog and podcast. And hiding away in that back little corner of the website will be the SoundCloud link and the hot links that we just talked about. If you have ideas for a show or questions about the show, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what you think is important and what we ought to be talking about. You're probably listening to the show on your smartphone using one of the modern podcast distribution apps. Please ask all of your friends to listen to us on their modern podcast distribution app, like Google or Apple or all those things. We're there. Just search for a Massachusetts Climate Action podcast. I want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. Because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector, and maybe its burial sector, over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. So, Mariah, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Matthew, thank you so much for a fascinating discussion. Really very interesting. I wish you guys the best of luck.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.